I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, where it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour, a weekly program of news, views, reviews, and interviews from the mole's underground and undermining perspective. I'm your host, Clayton Morgridge, along with our engineer, Carl Vandervoort. On today's Old Mole, we'll be discussing the movement of landless workers in Brazil, the current film, The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada, and differences of opinion over imperialism in the anti-war movement, and what happens when we don't know what we do does. Stay tuned. Now, first up, Andrea Ferreira of Brazil's Landless Workers Movement spoke last night at Portland State and will be speaking again at a location near you. We'll give you the details in a few minutes. Andrea Ferreira is here in the studio along with her translator, Lucina Lira, and they're here to talk now with the Old Mole's Bill Resnick. Bill?
All right, I'm going to try and get the pronunciations right, Clayton. I'm sure I won't. It's Andrea Ferreira and Lucina Lira. Welcome to KBOO. I don't think I got it right either. You can...
Bem-vinda a
KBOO. Andrea Ferreira represents the MST, the Brazilian Landless Workers Movement. She's going to be speaking in Portland today and tomorrow four times. We'll talk about that at the end. You're invited. It's going to be at Lewis and Clark, PSU, Pacific University, as well as Liberty Hall tomorrow night at 7 p.m. for the whole Portland community. But you're also invited to the college lectures. The Brazilian Landless Workers Movement has over 2 million members. Many now, in fact, have acquired land that they live in and farm communally, and they also engage in very democratic, successful self-rule within their communities. Lucilene Lira works here at the Western State Center. She's an organizer there. She also organized Andrea Ferreira's tour, trip to Portland, and will be translating. Andrea Ferreira, tell us about the MST, the Brazilian Workers Landless Workers Movement.
Você pode falar pouco do MST?
Então, primeiramente, bom dia a todos os ouvintes da Rádio KBOO. O MST agradece essa oportunidade.
So, firstly, I would like to thank you all, a KBOO listener, on behalf of the MST.
Então, o Movimento Sem Terra, né, há 20 anos, vem atuando na organização dos trabalhadores rurais no sentido de avançar no processo de reforma agrária no Brasil.
So, for the past 20 years, the MST has been working in organizing rural communities to advance agrarian reform in Brazil.
Então, a concentração da terra no Brasil é problema social e econômico muito grande.
Land concentration in Brazil is a big social and economic problem.
E a luta pela reforma agrária consiste na democratização dessas terras sendo distribuídas às milhares de famílias que existem no Brasil.
So, therefore, our struggle for land reform consists in democratizing the land to distribute for the thousands of landless families in Brazil.
O processo de ocupação dessas terras que estão concentradas tem trazido, nesses 20 anos, saldo de 350 mil famílias assentadas.
So, the victories we have had in occupying lands in the past 20 years is that right now we have 350,000 families that already have their own land.
O processo de reforma agrária que nós defendemos consiste em uma alternativa econômica, social, cultural e entre todos tantos outros elementos que fazem parte da dignidade das famílias brasileiras.
So, the process that we engage, the struggle that engages for social, political, economic, and cultural for the dignity of these families, these Brazilian families.
Mm-hmm. 350,000 families must be much more than a million people, actually. But they organize very, very differently. It seems to me that the communities set up by the MST, at least what I've read, are very, very different. They aren't organized in the sort of the capitalista model that we know about.
Basicamente, com 350 mil famílias, significa mais de 1 milhão de pessoas, e ele assume que essas famílias estão organizadas de uma maneira que não é uma organização baseada no sistema capitalista. Você pode falar um pouco sobre isso?
Uhum. Bom, então, junto com a luta pela democratização da terra, também existe a luta por uma política e um conjunto de recursos que garantam os investimentos na área da produção para esses assentamentos.
So, besides fighting for democratization of the land, we also fighting for a policy for agricultural production.
Como o modelo econômico e agrícola não está voltado à pequena agricultura, o nosso esforço é no sentido de construir cooperativas de produção agrícola.
So, the economic liberal model is not oriented to these families. Therefore, our effort is really to work with these families to create cooperatives.
Mas, de forma geral, todas as formas de produção, elas estão diretamente vinculadas, no Brasil, ao sistema capitalista.
However, all production in Brazil are, in some ways, still linked to capitalist production.
E, num primeiro momento, existe esse reflexo na organização dos assentamentos.
So, at the first moment, we have some reflection in the movement about how to address this capitalist system.
Mas o nosso esforço tem sido em discutir, em criar alternativas econômicas que superem a exploração do trabalho e que estimulem a cooperação entre os assentados.
So, we have a lot of effort to have discussions on how to create economic alternatives that it goes beyond, going above how the work is organized.
Nesse sentido, nós temos criado várias experiências com êxito.
So, in this context, we have created a lot of very successful experiences.
De assentamentos coletivos, onde não existem divisão de lotes e onde os meios de produção são coletivos.
In which we have the settlements in which there is no division of small land for individual families, but it's very collective.
E essas experiências trazem presente para nós que é possível criar uma outra alternativa econômica em contraposição, em enfrentamento a esse modelo do capitalismo.
So, and this experience has have showed us that it's possible to organize a new type of model that counters the capitalist model.
Mm-hmm. And how are these governed, the cooperatives? In what ways are they governed? How do they manage to maintain themselves and make decisions without being run by a capitalist owner-manager?
Como essas cooperativas são administradas, como são mantidas, qual é o processo de decisão para que se evitem que elas sejam retornadas ao sistema capitalista de decisão, de administração?
Uhum. Bom, existe no Brasil uma legislação que permite a abertura de cooperativas e de associações agrícolas.
There's a legislation in Brazil that allows the creation and operation of cooperatives and associations.
E nós podemos acessar uma política de créditos que também viabiliza a formação dessas cooperativas e a sua administração de recursos.
And therefore we have the abilities to come together with a policy for getting credits from the banks that also having access to subsidies for agriculture.
Bom, nós procuramos aproveitar o espaço e as condições dadas pelas cooperativas para implementar o que nós chamamos da cooperação agrícola.
So therefore we take advantage of this cooperative model of this legislation in order to really implement a cooperative collaboration in cooperation through the cooperatives.
E isso visa superar o modelo do presidencialismo, que é comum nas cooperativas do Brasil, e também o exercício dos valores humanos, de solidariedade, de cooperação, de companheirismo.
So therefore we try through this the model is basically we're cooperating the cooperative model in order to really go beyond this assistentialism and presidentialism that the co-op model offers and really to exercise new values like values of cooperation, values of participation.
E uma outra iniciativa ligada ao sistema de produção é a preservação do meio ambiente.
And another initiative that we have is the preservation of the environment.
Então, existem algumas experiências no campo da agroecologia, da produção de sementes orgânicas.
So we have some experience in the agroecology and also in the production and preservation of seeds.
E nós temos vários cursos de formação na área da agroecologia, do meio ambiente, que também visa trabalhar a consciência, a educação da população sem terra.
We also we have provided a lot of trainings, a lot of workshops that we are dealing with the agroecology, but also changing the consciousness of the people to be aware of this process.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole here talking to Andrea Fajeda of the Brazilian Landless Movement, translated by Lucilene Lira. Of the Western States Center. We've been talking about the Brazilian landless movements and particularly the successes they've had in occupying land, getting title to land, farming land, and creating really healthy communities. We've been talking to some extent about the way those communities are run in an alternative model. Let me continue on that vein. What happens when people disagree? I mean, I'm sure there are disagreements in the MST and in within communities. Those are inevitable. What happens when people disagree? How do you structure those discussions?
O que acontece quando existe desacordo no movimento e como acontecem as discussões para quando não tem entendimento no movimento? Como a discussão é estruturada? Como se dá esse processo de discussão?
Assentamentos.
Bom, não é movimento em geral.
Para quando sai os assentamentos?
Não, ele fala assim que não é, bom, no movimento tem que ter desentendimento, as pessoas não concordam com certas decisões ou políticas. Como que vocês lidam com esse processo de quando as pessoas não têm unidade?
Dentro do movimento.
É.
Bom, então, uma das principais características do Movimento Sem Terra nesses 20 anos foi consolidar um conjunto de princípios e normas internas que garante que a unidade seja um dos principais elementos de avanço da nossa organização.
So, one of the characteristics of the movement is that we put together a group of principles in which unity and is like one of the major areas that we have to come together.
Então, não existe uma linha hierárquica no Movimento Sem Terra. Existem coletivos de pessoas que existem nos estados e a nível nacional.
So therefore, in our movement, there is no hierarchy, but what exists is a collective group of people that organize throughout the states.
Esses coletivos têm a tarefa de estudar, interpretar a realidade, encaminhar propostas para o conjunto do Movimento Sem Terra.
So those collective, those group of people, they have the task to study the Brazilian reality and to provide guidance to how they are going to address these issues at the state level.
Bom, e logicamente o movimento envolve um conjunto muito grande de opiniões que são diferentes, que se contrapõem, mas nós procuramos encaminhar as decisões políticas através do consenso político.
So of course, because we are a large movement, there's a lot of diversity of opinion, but we are trying to work in coming together through consensus.
E nesses coletivos, todas as pessoas têm direito a participar, a dar sua opinião, a argumentar politicamente.
So, in the collectives, everybody have a chance and space to argue, to put together their opinion, to disagree, and then come together as making decisions.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the big disagreements must now be about how to deal with the Lula government, the Workers' Party, the PT, that gained, that was elected with such high hopes by poor people and with the incredible participation and enthusiasm of poor people, has in fact
what you do is you begin first sign of a cold, like when you first begin to feel that slight.
From the energy department. No, they can't be used. For the answer, what is for centrifuging uranium?
And that they baby friend.
What was their, I think, their first hit?
War?
Huh? What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Say it again.
That wasn't
there. No. What was...
Que o Lula agora é a criança dos olhos do FMI, do Banco Mundial e do Wall Street, né? Que ele então nem fazendo nada para realmente forçar o FMI. E então, bom, deve ter muito discussão no movimento e desacordo com relação, que decisão tomar com relação ao governo Lula. Então ele quer dizer, qual é a posição do MST com relação ao governo Lula atualmente?
Uhum. Bom, enquanto Movimento Sem Terra, nós, desde o princípio da nossa organização, nós procuramos manter certa autonomia em relação a qualquer partido político.
As a movement, since it's our beginning, we try to maintain our autonomy in relationship to any political parties.
E essa autonomia, ela nos dá condições de criticar o governo, da gente se opor às políticas que nós julgamos contrárias aos interesses dos trabalhadores.
So this principle of autonomy provides us with the tools to be critical in front of the government, especially when the government is not defending policies that benefit the working people.
Mas o Movimento Sem Terra também tem uma análise e uma interpretação de que essas políticas neoliberais, que há cerca de 15 anos têm diminuído a ação dos estados nacionais, em grande parte é responsável pela inoperância do governo.
But we also have an understanding and an analysis that throughout the past 15 years of neoliberal policies, that has really impaired the government of having induced some actions.
Então, ao mesmo tempo que nós colocamos as nossas críticas pontuais ao governo, nós também nos juntamos em uma luta internacional contra esse sistema, contra o Banco Mundial, contra o FMI, contra a OMC.
At the same time, when we have a very strong position against Lula in which identify specific issues, we also have a strong position in relationship to the policies that come from the IMF and the World Bank.
E de qualquer forma, das elites no poder. Então, o nosso esforço é no sentido de que a direita não retome novamente a presidência da República, o governo.
And at the same time, social movements in Brazil are very concerned and afraid of the return of the right in Brazil, and therefore we are trying to make an effort that this really doesn't happen.
Que o Lula ainda significa um canal de diálogo para nós, para as esquerdas.
That Lula still signifies a channel of dialogue for our movement.
Mm-hmm. So he's been extremely disappointing, it seems to me, at the amount of land that has been deeded to landless workers, and the sort of the effort to make legal and develop more communities of the poorest of the poor, and the land is available. It could have been done, and it wasn't, or it hasn't been. Although he's done something, and he's protected some. Is that the dilemma that people face?
Ele entende que o povo está muito desiludido com a falta de rapidez de assentar famílias. E que, então, como que vocês verem isso? Isso é verdade, que o povo está desiludido com a falta de implementação do programa de reforma agrária?
Bom, a princípio, havia uma grande expectativa na realização da reforma agrária com o Lula no governo.
From the beginning, there was this really high expectation in relationship that Lula was going to implement an agrarian reform.
Mas a reforma agrária encontra-se muito lenta, né? E a maioria das nossas metas não estão sendo cumpridas.
But agrarian reform has been extremely slow and a lot of our goals are not being met.
Mm-hmm. This is KBOO 90.7 FM. There's so much to talk about and so little time. I think we have to end the interview now, but before we get off the air, I would like Lucilene Lira, who is translating from Portuguese for this interview, to tell us about, invite people to come.
Yeah.
How can they hear so much more?
Exactly. Actually, today we are going to Forest Grove. She's going to be talking at Pacific University this evening at 7 p.m. And tomorrow there are three full day of events that people can join us. One of which is in the evening at 7 p.m. at Liberty Hall, 311 North Ivy Street in the northeast side. We are going to be showing a film as well about MST, which is a very good film. And then at Union, 327, and at 4 o'clock at Lewis and Clark, student co-op in Upper Tamarack. So, mm-hmm. In a discussion with Andrea, and also what is happening in Brazil and Latin America also is connected with the United States.
Yes, the MST is a real inspiration all over the world. It's so important. Thank you so much for talking to us, Andrea Ferreira, and we really invite people to go to any... What website can people go to find out about all of these?
Yeah,
we have to get off the air.
They can go to Friends of the MST, mstbrazilwithz.org.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Quem é você que não sabe o que diz? Meu Deus do céu, que palpite infeliz. Salve Estácio, Salgueiro, Mangueira, Oswaldo Cruz e Matriz. Que sempre souberam muito bem. E a vila não quer abafar ninguém, só quer mostrar que faz samba também. Quem é você que não sabe o que diz? Meu Deus do céu, que palpite infeliz. Salve Estácio, Salgueiro, Mangueira, Oswaldo Cruz e Matriz. Que sempre souberam muito bem. Que a vida não quer abafar ninguém. Só quer mostrar que faz samba também.
And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. And it's time now for the Well Read Red.
America is the greatest country in the world. This mantra is repeated time and again. It doesn't matter if it spews from the traps of right-wing conservatives crying out for ever more aggressive policies sculpted to defeat the enemies of freedom, or from the lips of liberal progressives demanding that we take back this great nation of ours. The idea that the U.S. or any country could aspire to be the greatest should raise our level of concern, not pride. As we move closer to the third anniversary of the U.S. attack on Iraq, there is a growing number of American citizens who oppose the war and occupation, but it is not clear how this will impact the continuing development and evolution of the anti-war movement. What is clear is in the 3 years since millions of people gathered worldwide to protest the impending invasion of Iraq, anti-war activists in the U.S. have worked in crisis to build and maintain a substantive movement able to address a wide range of issues against the efforts to narrow the focus of mass mobilizations to what amounts to a stop this war message. Much has been written and debated nationally on this core division, and while Oregon will make a good showing with over 130 diverse faith, peace, and social justice organizations, working to mobilize citizens to come out and protest the war on March 19th, dissensions regarding focus persist locally, with at least Gold Star Families for Peace choosing not to openly sponsor the march. I can understand that activists who want to focus the movement's efforts on stopping this war now have an intimate connection to the costs of this war. For military families and veterans, death is close to home. Those who have experienced loss hope to avoid more of it through their actions. Many have taken the position that the idea of dying for your country is not always noble. There's tremendous passion and anger to bring to the streets. But what do we have to say to Americans? What do we have to say to the world whose people are watching us with hope that our resistance will grow? Can we win by putting the problem of U.S. foreign policy on the back burner long enough to get our kids home alive? And in the face of this life and death immediacy, can the left say, you know, I hear you, but changing the world takes time. We've got to look down the road. Is the push for a single focus stop the war message a strategic move? Can we expect this layer of activists will naturally transition post-war to participate in social justice movements as a result of coming to terms with the broader implications of the war in Iraq? If the compromise is we won't talk bad about America or mention imperialism, then my belief is no. Anti-war and peace activists need an anti-imperialist message for themselves just as much as the movement needs it to grow, sustain, and succeed in stopping capitalism from destroying the planet. I know I'm doing exactly what conservatives in the movement are afraid of. I'm being inflammatory. But I am reasonable, even rational, and I have no problem saying America is not the greatest country in the world. Americans have a share in imperialism. Imperialism allows capitalists from developed rich countries to extract profit from the working class of underdeveloped poor countries. The majority of this profit is kept by the capitalists themselves, but some of it is shared with the working class of these developed countries in the form of higher living standards, cheaper consumer goods. And all of this works to lead good, hardworking people to support imperialist foreign policy as being in the best interest of the country and our national security. It is natural, moral, positively good. The left has to talk about imperialism. U.S. foreign policy serves the needs of corporations, and the military is expected to do the dirty work. There is no plan to change that. And I think people are getting this. Okay, so in order to advance the cause of social justice, we also may have to mention that capitalism sucks and is bad for all people at all times. Not a real popular position currently, but perhaps with some role play, we can make some inroads. How about this for an icebreaker? Imperialism is about extending control or authority over foreign entities as a means of acquisition and or maintenance of empires, either through direct territorial conquest or by exerting control on the policies and or economy of other countries. The military will be asked to police the world and subjugate its people to the will of corporations. There is no shortage of enemies. America is an imperialist nation, true or false? However critical to the future survival of all peoples, the idea of the United States as an imperialist country may not be an easy sell. National pride runs deep. So do attachments to private property, heterosexuality, white skin privilege, male domination, class hierarchy. Only strategic organizing in a protracted struggle can bear fruit. I'd like to close with a bit of reflection and insight from Angela Davis, interviewed by Eduardo Medida in the February issue of In These Times. Quote, I always thought the demonstrations were supposed to demonstrate the potential power of movements. Ongoing movements at certain strategic moments need to mobilize and render visible everyone who is touched by the call for justice, equality, and peace. But these days, we tend to think of that process of rendering the movement visible as the very substance of the movement itself. If this is the case, then the millions who go home after the demonstration have concluded that they do not necessarily feel responsible to further build support for the cause. They are able to return to their private spaces and express their relationship to this movement in private, individual ways. Organizing is not synonymous with mobilizing. When organizing is subordinated to mobilizing, what do you do after the successful mobilization? How can we produce a sense of belonging to communities and struggle that is not evaporated by the onslaught of our everyday routines? How do we build movements capable of generating the power to compel governments and corporations to curtail their violence? Ultimately, how can we successfully resist global capitalism and its drive for dominance? The late Harry Magdoff, socialist and devoted anti-imperialist, once said, "You have to be a pessimist of mind, but an optimist of the heart. The job is to reach the people." This has been Denise Morris this morning on the Old Mole Variety Hour with the Well-Read Red. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Denise. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO, your community-owned and community-run radio station. Next up on the show, we have our movie moles, Fran Michel and Denise Morris. Today, they review the three burials of Melquiades Estrada. Take it away, movie moles.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with Denise Morris to discuss the three burials of Melquiades Estrada, the first cinematic feature directed by Tommy Lee Jones. The script was written by Guillermo Arriaga, and like his earlier screenplays, Amores Perros and 21 Grams, it features a fractured chronology that says more about character than sequence. The violent and obnoxious new border patrolman, Mike Norton, played by Barry Pepper, accidentally shoots shy cowboy Melquiades, played by Julio Cedillo, and covers up the incident. Even when Sheriff Frank Belmont, played by Dwight Yoakam, learns the truth, he doesn't bother to pursue justice in the death of a man he calls just a wetback. But diner waitress Rachel, played by Melissa Leo, who's having affairs with both Frank and ranch foreman Pete Perkins, overhears the story and passes the information on to Pete, played by Tommy Lee Jones. Seeking justice for his good friend Mel, Pete kidnaps Mike and forces him to unearth Melquiades from a pauper's grave and then ride to Mexico, where Pete plans to fulfill a promise to Melquiades to see that if he dies, he's returned to his wife and children in Mexico and buried in his small hometown of Jimenez. Where the first part of the film consists of small-town intrigues and murder mystery, the second consists of Western journey, cowboys on horseback chased by Border Patrol agents in SUVs and helicopters, and aided by a coyote, a curandera, and other helpful Mexicans. So, what do you think, Denise? Is this a politically progressive film? In what way might it be?
Well, I saw previews of this film, and I actually thought it looked good from previews, which I think is a very rare experience, because I think previews can make films that might otherwise be good look really horrifying. So, and I love Westerns. So I thought, well, this looks interesting. It kind of looks like a lot of the films that I really like. And for me, it did bring to mind some of Sam Peckinpah's films, and actually also The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And we get to one of the reasons why, but I think most reviewers kind of recognize that the film is taking up a lot of traditions, film traditions, as well as a political subject matter, which is the immigration, and not just immigration, but border politics. And that has been taken up in films prior. Jack Nicholson, I think, in the film called The Border. I would have to really jar my memory to recall much about it, but
A Touch of Evil certainly explores border questions, and this has the advantage over that, certainly, of not casting an Anglo as a Mexican, as Touch of Evil does.
Yes, and I would always like to hope that Orson Welles would have rejected that, but was probably pressured by the studios, so I still hold him in esteem. But yeah, there are actual Mexicans playing Mexicans in the film, a step forward. But I don't think that could be its only qualification for being progressive. But there are some things that we looked at that we felt helped the film be unlike other films. And one of the things that stands out, oddly enough, is, and as you mentioned, middle-aged people being sexual. And not being just sexual, but being sort of both promiscuous, but also a little bit kinky.
Yeah. The Melissa Leo character, we see Rachel and Frank sitting around naked on the couch in a post-non-coital moment, actually. You know, and they're not Hollywood gorgeous. They don't have perfect bodies. And it's just fine, you know?
Yeah.
which is very refreshing. I mean, that's not something that we see a lot in Hollywood films, although we see a lot of people having sex.
Yes, we do. This film, we don't see a lot of that. Actually, there's a lot of longing. Some of that is longing for other people and questioning where your allegiances are in a small town where everybody knows you and people sort of know that certain things are going on and they're recognized on some level, but not acknowledged fully. And also that there's a longing for home, which I think is the one place that I believe this film makes itself grapple with politics in a way, because
the lead character, or the subject, who is
title character.
The title character. He has described his home as this beautiful place in which you would feel like you could reach out and hug the mountains, and that it would change you.
The air is completely pure, and it's so beautiful, and it's just so wonderful. I mean, we see in flashbacks the interaction between Pete and Melquiades. Melquiades shows him this photograph that he has. He says, "This is, you know, this is my wife. These are my children. You know, we're from this beautiful, beautiful little tiny town." And he draws him a map. And, you know, I mean, there's clearly, you know, a very kind of nostalgic, longing, kind of idealized view of what his home life meant to him.
And contrary to the perception that Americans hold, that the American dream is so compelling and so far-reaching that everybody wants to cross the border and come to live in the great America. And in fact, Melquiades says, "I don't want to be buried here. Please take me away from these billboards and bury me in this beautiful place."
Yeah.
So there's this exploration in a way about, you know, what is home? To what degree is home real? How do we hold mm-hmm. home in our memory? And in fact, there were some interesting aspects about our questions about the border raised in a couple of reviews. One which just sort of says, you know, raises the question: is the border a geographical fact, or is it really a construct of social relations and of mm-hmm. class relations, race yeah. relations? So,
yeah, I mean, and it, certainly, I think we do get a sense that it's a political rather than a geographic construct in this film. Since, I mean, the landscape doesn't change perceptibly as we apparently cross the border. I mean, it's still the same earth. I mean, there is a scene of crossing the river, which does mark a kind of transition physical border. But it's, you know, there isn't that kind of sharp, like suddenly everything looks different. Although it is true that the scenes that are set in Mexico tend to be visually much nicer. I mean, all of the scenes sort of in the country, once you get out of the town, everything looks better because the town is this dingy, I mean, you know, people live in manufactured homes and there's chain link fences and it's just, you know, it's ugly. It's an ugly town.
It is. It's just one of those towns you can't believe people actually live there. And in fact, you do get a sense that people are kind of coming through, but there's a lot of action in the Sands Motel. I think it's the
have a motel and a diner, and it's all kind of this little complex of. Mm-hmm.
And it's the setting for the wife of the Border Patrol. We should probably get to that point.
Yeah.
who is completely bored? They've moved from Cincinnati. Mike Norton is kind of the catalyst for the film in a way. He is a Border Patrol agent who is very much. His character contains all of the ills, all of the racist, violent, hideous...
Sexist.
Yeah.
I mean, he spends his free time and even his time at work reading Hustler, jacking off. He comes home and has sex with his wife, and, you know, she's completely uninterested in what's going on and continues watching television and slicing zucchini. There's, you know, he has no particularly attractive qualities.
No, and
at that point in the film.
Yeah, and not through most of it, although the actor, Barry Pepper, does a nice job of playing that character. You mentioned in your intro the incident, this what is kind of seen as an accidental killing, and yet his character is so abhorrent that you find once he's labeled as the killer, and Pete, the rancher who is Melquiades' friend, who is the one who's supposed to take him back to his homeland to be buried, he finds out that this. Mike Norton has killed his friend, goes, gets him, and then the film goes from being sort of a small town murder mystery to a almost sweeping Western in the old tradition of those great Westerns we like. A bit gritty, mm-hmm. but well-paced and interesting in a way. if folks who've seen The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly recall Clint Eastwood being drugged through the desert by the other character whose name escapes me now, they're looking for this pot of gold or this gold in a cemetery. And in fact, you know, there is a kind of link there because Tommy Lee Jones' character, Pete, is bringing his friend and this fugitive border patrolman to bury his friend. He's finding a cemetery and looking for this, what becomes somewhat mythical, small village in the middle of nowhere. So,
yeah, I mean, and it's, I mean, the middle of nowhere looks really beautiful in this film. The cinematography is lovely. But there's also, I mean, there's definitely a critique of the racism of the Anglos in the town and the racism of the border guard, Mike, who, although he doesn't intend to shoot Melquiades, he doesn't know what he's shooting at, essentially. So it's a completely sort of panicked and irresponsible act on his part that leads to the death. But we've also seen him earlier, you know, sort of beating, and he breaks a woman's nose when he catches her. She's a as she's crossing the border, and he's rounding people up, and he's reprimanded by his superior in the border patrol. But it's clear that he's a little bit too ready to treat the immigrants roughly. And the other border guards don't seem to want to do that, but it doesn't seem to be because they care about them as human beings, but because it would just make trouble for them, or, you know, there might be paperwork involved.
Right, and nobody seems to want to deal with much. And a lot of these characters are portrayed somewhat as bungling. The sheriff, who Dwight Yoakam plays to the best of his ability, is somewhat bungling, and yet he shows a bit of compassion for Pete, Tommy Lee Jones' character, in that he recognizes that they had a friendship, which I think is one interesting aspect of the film, which is Pete and Mel have a friendship. They both have names, and they both are dimensional, whereas most of the other townspeople refer to him as the Mexican or in other more derogatory terms, but he becomes a kind of generic, as if he might be the only Mexican in the town, when in fact we know that's, you know,
clearly not true.
Clearly.
And when he's buried in the pauper's grave, they put up a cross, and the man writing his name on the cross says, "What's his name? Melquiades, what's his last name?" And nobody knows it when they're doing that. And where's he from? Well, nobody knows. Mexico. And so the cross says, "Melquiades, Mexico." He's just sort of the generic Mexican. He's sort of socially buried in this town before he's physically buried. And then brought up again, and his corpse is toted through the desert and across the border. And that's one of the disadvantages of this film, or problems with this film, is that, in fact, the main Mexican character is a corpse for most of the movie. It really is about the Anglo characters. Although it's about people crossing the border back and forth, we don't, I think, get a real clear sense of what's driving that. One can say, oh, well, you know, there's something about looking for work, but it's not entirely clear. One of the border guards, when some get through and don't get caught, he says, well, somebody has to pick the strawberries. But we don't really get much sense of the dynamics of the relations, the economic and labor relations and sort of cultural relations that drive that migration back and forth.
Indeed, and the film is much more about a personal journey, and it kind of builds the characters a bit as composites. But it was a much more interesting film than I had expected, and I thought raised some very important questions, and maybe a start, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, and it hints at the end at some really much more interesting things. You were saying earlier that, I mean, one of the things suggested perhaps at the end is that white characters, it turns out Pete doesn't know his friend as well as he thought he did. You know, that it's just, he sort of imagined this relationship that he has with this man. And that it turns out that you know, you really don't go home again, that everybody in the film is in one way or another displaced, and that the idea of home, or the idea of the ideal home, whether it's the American dream or, you know, the hometown back in Mexico, is in some sense a fantasy that people imagine for themselves.
Well, Fran, we're talking about the three burials of Melquiades Estrada, And still playing out at the Fox, although we maybe wish it were playing somewhere like the Hollywood. But Matinee is good. Yeah, you can wait and see if maybe it'll show up at the Kennedy School. But recommended, I think. Yeah. Thanks for listening. Denise Morth was Fran Michel for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And you are tuned to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge, now with some reflections on not knowing what we do does. Why is it that world leaders consistently fail to foresee the likely consequences of their actions? We hardly need to be reminded at this late date that the Bush administration and its supporters were blind to most of the likely results of going to war against Iraq, including how welcoming the Iraqi people would be to being invaded and occupied, their willingness to form a national government to our liking, and the impact of the occupation on the rest of the Islamic world. Writing in the current New York Review, David Cole remarks, "President Bush is fond of repeating, 'We are fighting them over there so we don't have to fight them here at home.' As a counterterrorism strategy, this appears to be a disaster. Fighting them over there has since 2003 meant committing over 100,000 troops, hundreds of billions of dollars, and thousands of lives to a conflict in Iraq whose only clear connection to the war on terror has been its encouragement of terrorism. The U.S. attack on Iraq has created the world's principal breeding and training ground for anti-American terrorists. Many highly informed commentators have argued that the war in Iraq, based at best on faulty intelligence and at worst on outright lies, was a major diversion from the real enemy, Al-Qaeda, and the terrorists loosely linked with it, and that the war with Iraq has therefore made us less secure." That's David Cole. Now, many people have pointed out this danger before the invasion, but the Bush people blundered on, their heads planted firmly in the sand. And what about the cartoons published by the Danish newspaper? Should the outrage of Muslims have been such a surprise? How should we understand this problem of failing to understand what we're doing? Is it simply that people are too impatient to look ahead, so eager for action that they don't pause to ask themselves what might happen as a result of what they plan? Well, that's part of it. It's easy to want some short-term payoff so badly that we grab for it without pausing to imagine the long-term consequences of our grab. This short-term focus helps to explain, for example, why corporations do things that undermine even their own survival in order to prop up the current bottom line, Enron's malfeasance being just one example. But the problem with the examples I spoke of earlier, the war on Iraq or publishing cartoons offensive to Muslims, is not just a failure to think ahead. It's not looking ahead from the point of view of people who will be on the receiving end of what we do. The philosopher Michel Foucault has said, "People usually know what they are doing, and often they know why they do what they do, but what they don't know is what they do does." We often don't know what we do does. I think what Foucault is driving at here is that the net effect of our actions, what we have actually done, depends on how our actions are received, how they are interpreted. My words mean what they mean, not according to my private thoughts about them, but according to their interpretation in our public language. In the same way, the meaning of my actions is not simply what I intended to do, but how they impact upon and are interpreted by others. I may think I'm complimenting you, but if my words are insults in your language, then I have, in fact, insulted you. I may mean to help you by some action of mine, but whether I have helped you or harmed you depends on how my action unfolds in your life, and in your life as you understand it. No individual or group can unilaterally control what it actually does or what its actions really mean. This helps us to understand what is going on in the dispute over the Danish cartoons that depict, some in an insulting way, the Islamic prophet Muhammad. The editor intended, so he says, to make a point about freedom of the press. The Muslim community sees the drawings as an insult to Islam, a slap in the face of their religious faith. So we might say that we have two cultural systems of interpretation. In one of them, a drawing of a man with a bomb in his turban can be seen as satire and a free expression of opinion. In the other, the same drawing is a blatant act of disrespect. Our commitment to the right of free expression carries with it an obligation to tolerate disrespect, to put up with being insulted. As the cartoonist Art Spiegelman put it in The Nation, if there's a right to make cartoons, then there has to be a right to insult. And if there's no right to make cartoons, well, I'm in big trouble. You can't always have polite discourse. End of quote. Of course, we should remember that not everyone in the U.S. is so keen on free expression and as willing to be insulted. Witness the perennial attempts in Congress to put a constitutional ban on flag burning, or the outcry over insults to the Virgin Mary in a painting at the Brooklyn Museum of Art a few years ago. Nevertheless, to be committed to an open society with the right to say and draw whatever we want does carry with it the willingness to be insulted. It's natural for us, then, as defenders of an open society, to expect that everyone should put up with insults. Get over it, we think. But as a matter of fact, whether we like it or not every culture is committed to an open society. Moreover, not every culture we bump up against in this global society feels sufficiently secure and protected to bear up under insults without fearing that their very existence is under attack. For many complicated and long-standing reasons, from the Crusades to Abu Ghraib, Muslims in many parts of the world feel that their right to exist is not just questioned, but being assaulted. So when they see published cartoons that violate well-known Islamic prohibitions against picturing the Prophet, and which moreover represent him in a disrespectful way, it does not come easily to them to interpret those drawings as satire they should let pass in the interests of free speech. If the publishers of the cartoons had been aware of this, they might not have been so surprised at the response. The U.S. invasion of Iraq is more complicated. First of all, there is the way the government falsely represented that action to us as part of the war on terror, overthrowing a tyrant, and bringing democracy to the Middle East. And then there is the action, as many of us interpret it, an effort to maintain and extend U.S. control over the politics and the resources of the region. The Bush image doctors gave serious attention to how their war and their story of the war would be received by the American public. But it seems to have had no clue about how it would be interpreted by people in the Middle East and what they would do about it. So the White House policymakers had no way to wrap their minds around how many Arabs, including lots of young guys with anger and energy to burn, would interpret the U.S. invasion, namely as a confirmation of the wisdom of Osama bin Laden and every other radical calling for holy war against the infidel. As a result, the U.S. is fighting and losing to an international insurgency whose zeal and motivation it does not understand. We have no idea of what we are doing does. I submit that it is not possible for anyone to know how their actions are received by others when they act coercively or unilaterally upon those others. It is only through dialogue, conversation, negotiation, and cooperation with others that we can know how our words and actions are understood. Only when policies are created and carried out by and in conversation with those who must live them, do those policies have a chance of success. This not only opposes war as a way to change the world, it also challenges the whole idea of authority, the idea that some groups, elected or unelected, should have the power to determine the lives of others. I'm Clayton Morgeridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And that's it for the Old Mole Variety Hour this week. Join us again next Monday at 9 when the Mole will be back with more results of her exploration of the underside of this strange society of ours. I'm Clayton Morgeridge. Our engineer is Carl Vandervoort. Stay tuned now for Scott Forrester with Monday on the Environment.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Listen to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Coming up will be a special hour-long version of Monday on the Environment. Host Scott Forrester's guests are Oregon activist Harry Lonsdale speaking about campaign finance reform and attorney Dan Meek on PGE.